Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, which recently lowered tuition by 30% and guarantees graduation in 4 years to all students who meet certain criteria. Carthage ranks 15th in best value among Midwest regional colleges, according to U.S. News and World Report. More information available at carthage.edu. Welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And first of all, it is a delight to welcome back to the program Nan Calvert, who is one of our monthly visitors to the morning show. And so for the last time for 2020, Nan Calvert, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. Yes, we made it to the last show of 2020. That's quite an accomplishment, I think.
Yeah, right. 2020 has been one heck of a year in more ways than one. And yes, I'm glad that we are still here, left standing, and able to look into 2021 with expectation. But anyway, we've had great conversations through the year, and you've brought in some very, very interesting guests. And I must say, I am exceptionally intrigued by the guest that you have with us today. Tell us about Allison Madison and how the two of you connected.
Well, this is a particularly timely segment because we are now in the season where we need to increase our safety and our traction. And we do that, of course, with road salt, sidewalk salt, de-icing chemicals, ice melt, whatever name you choose to use. And we've done that for so long that we forget that when we throw it out there, it has a decidedly negative impact. It doesn't just melt the ice and then the salt crystals, or chloride crystals really, go away. They end up somewhere, and they end up in our water. And we're becoming increasingly aware of the impact that has. So for a long time, when we did water quality testing, we didn't go very deep. And so we weren't aware of the problem that chlorides pose to water quality. But then when testing went a little bit deeper into those bodies of water, we realized that chloride contamination is a very serious problem in the Root Pike watershed, as well as everywhere else that uses these chloride-based chemicals. So that's what we're going to talk about today. But in Wisconsin, we're very lucky to have a group called Saltwise. And they do wonderful work educating people about how to use these chemicals, because that's what they are, chemicals, how and when, and, you know, educating people, raising awareness of the impact on water quality. And of course, with Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network, we interact with Saltwise relatively frequently. And then this year, I was lucky to be invited to a planning committee by Allison Madison, our guest today, to work on a couple of things that Allison is going to talk about in depth. So that's how I came to know Allison, and luckily she was available to be on the radio with us today to talk about the programs that are going on and the impact of chlorides and what we can all do about it to lessen that impact.
Excellent. Well, Allison Madison, that's quite a build-up you've just received from Nan Calvert, and we're really excited that you can be part of the morning show today. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much, Gregory, and thank you, Nan, for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here with everybody.
Can I get a bit of clarification first about the group that you are with, Wisconsin Saltwise? Is this the Wisconsin chapter of a larger organization, or is this something really unique to Wisconsin?
Yeah, thanks, Greg. So Wisconsin Saltwise has the name Wisconsin in it, But it actually kind of grew out of a number of organizations in the Dane County area. So back in around 2013, 2014, the City of Madison, Madison's Water Utility, Dane County, Madison-Dane County Public Health, and the Madison Sewerage District were all kind of came together around this issue or this concern of the growing concentrations of salt in our waters. So as Nan mentioned, salt is increasing, concentrations of salt are increasing in both our surface water, so lakes and streams, rivers, and also our drinking water. So both of these things have brought together, you know, kind of a diverse stakeholder group, people who are the water utility that is concerned with how much salt is in the water that is going into people's homes that they're drinking, the sewage district that is going to be discharging water into surface waters, and municipalities, you know, they're concerned with both of these issues. So these organizations kind of came together and tried to put their heads together and think about, you know, what can we do? How do we work to educate people? How do we work to educate the municipalities that are putting down about 50% of the salt that goes down, comes down with municipal salt plows and crews, and then about 50% is coming down or being applied through the use of like private winter maintenance companies and homeowners. So they recognize that we need to work to educate people and kind of change some norms around salt and have people recognize that it does have some costs in addition to the benefits, the public safety benefits. So it really was a Dane County-based organization, but they put together some really incredible tools on the website, electronic resources, outreach materials, posters, and all of these materials were recognized by people in other states. And so across the country, really, and even internationally, Saltwise's materials were beginning to be used. So while it's kind of started in Dane County, right now they're kind of growing up a little bit and reaching out to grow into a bit more of a statewide organization. There are not right now Saltwises in other states, but there's definitely interest in, across the country in the Snowbelt region from those states to use Saltwise materials and potentially, yes, have their own Saltwise kind of chapter one day.
Wow, very good. Could we get just a capsule summary of your professional life? Where are you from originally? And at what point did your kind of personal interests start to align with the work that you're doing now with Wisconsin Saltwise?
Yeah, so I grew up in northern Wisconsin, north of Eau Claire, and I just always loved being outside. My parents rented a little piece of land on a lake up in Chippewa County where I grew up. And so I got to spend a lot of time in the, especially the summer months, like out in a canoe or just swimming in some really gorgeous lakes up in northern Wisconsin. And was also able to go canoeing on rivers through youth organizations when I was growing up. And then in college, you know, as I learned more about a lot of the environmental threats to both our fresh water and just our environment in so many ways, it became clear to me that there's really an issue here of kind of education. People in our society were really distanced from the impacts of our consumption and our use of materials. As Nan said earlier, we kind of think that things kind of go away. You put salt down and it seems to disappear, right? You put your garbage out at the end of the driveway, or, you know, just down the apartment, you know, chute, and it disappears, right? It's gone. And we aren't really meant to, in our society, you know, like deal with kind of what happens after I say goodbye to this stuff, this material, or even what happened, how did something come to me, right? And what is the story of our food before it gets to us, or this new iPhone, right? These things just appear. And we're pretty distant from our impact on our planet. So in college, I really decided that I wanted to kind of be a part of reconnecting people to place and our how we use all the materials. You know, everything that's in our lives has come from this one earth that we share. And I feel like the distance that we have from our planet is something that impacts us both materially as we kind of degrade the planet, but also on more of a spiritual level as well, as we have this disconnection from the planet that gives us life and that connects us with all living things. So I went into environmental education right after undergrad and loved being outside with students, taking them through national parks or wilderness areas. But from there, I ended up moving into the classroom. So I taught science and environmental science for a number of years, so I could have deeper relationships with students and really be a part of a community. But in the last few years in the science classroom, I heard students say so many times to me, you know, Ms. Madison, like, we're learning about all of these problems. And it's not just in my science classroom, right? Like, our students today are really connected via their phones and social media to issues like climate change. And I even had a 7-year-old a friend of a daughter of a friend come up to me and tell me her story that she had written in her second or third grade classroom about what she wants to do if she was president one day. And it was, you know, she wants to take better care of the planet. You know, like, our kids recognize that there are a lot of really, really big issues, and it can be really overwhelming for students. So my students would ask me, you know, this is great, but like, what are we going to do? We're, you know, we're 14 and it sounds like our planet is doomed, you know, and if we don't have time for, you know, to grow up and to try to fix these things when we're adults. Like, we need the adults right now to be making changes. So I left the science classroom a couple years ago to pursue education that was a bit more applied around sustainability. And so that's kind of what led me here to Saltwise. You know, I think the problem of salt is very real and something that we all kind of have a role in, and the ability to make some pretty big impacts in through personal choices, and also by putting some, doing a little bit of advocacy work to ask that our communities are also being salt wise and protecting our fresh water.
Hmm. Very good. Nan Calvert, my eyes lit up. I bet yours did too when Allison Madison started talking about the way we think things magically disappear. It reminded me of all the times when you like to talk about the magic land of away,
right?
That unfortunately doesn't exist.
Right. It doesn't exist. Everything that we do has an impact one way or the other. So one of the things that I think it's important for people to have a deep understanding of is that everything that you do to the land, you also do to the water. It's all connected. Everything that goes on the surface of our planet, as well as below the surface, you end up impacting the water in one way or another. So when you put that chloride chemical down to melt the ice, as the ice is melting, it becomes stormwater runoff. And it's carried by stormwater runoff into the nearest body of water. And because it's heavier, it sinks. It sinks down towards the bottom. And it has terribly detrimental impacts on aquatic life, which Allison will talk about in a bit. But yeah, everything you do to the land, you also do to the water, no matter what it is. Sometimes it's good and sometimes it's not good. And so we know from the condition of our watershed, in the Root Pike watershed, a lot of things have happened to very negatively impact it. And that's why we work on water quality issues. Hmm.
For those of you just joining us, today is Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the morning show. And with her as a special guest, Allison Madison, who is with a group called Wisconsin Saltwise. And this is, in a sense, a work that represents a coalition of different organizations concerned about salt pollution. And in fact, they have a Salt Awareness Week that comes up in early January that we will talk about in just a moment. Allison Madison, I was relieved to hear that you have taught about this in the classroom, because I'm about to have you put on your teacher hat and tell us a little bit, educate us about salt. And maybe right off the bat, you could clarify the terms salt and chloride. I think when Nan was doing her preliminary announcement about what we were talking about today, we heard something about salt and something about chloride. And I think most of us have little, if any, understanding about those two terms. So I would appreciate any clarification you can give us about that.
All right, Greg. Well, I do have a degree in chemistry, so here goes.
And we don't. And remember that we don't. So keep the word short.
All right. So I do think when most people hear the word salt, we think first about, you know, table salt, right? Salt with our cooking. And that salt is sodium chloride. So sometimes we see it written out Na, capital N, little a, and then Cl, big C, little l. So that Na stands for sodium and the Cl for chloride. So sodium chloride, if you want to get a little more chemically technical, is an ionic compound of those little tiny sodium and chloride atoms, or they become ions and they bond together like little magnets. And the crystals are made up of all these, just imagine tiny little dots of sodium and chloride connected. So when we use salt, like rock salt, sidewalk salt, we're generally using sodium chloride. And it's just been mined from the earth. So if you think about, you know, where would we find lots of salt on the earth today? We might think about an ocean, right? And so all of the salt deposits that we have right now, they're a lot there. We don't really have them in Wisconsin, but we do next door in Michigan. There are huge deposits of salt under the earth. And those were laid down when there was a giant ocean, giant salty sea above what is now Michigan. I guess it would be below. There's been land on top of it now. So we go in and we mine that salt and we put it down to lower the melting temperature. So generally it's sodium chloride. That's like the cheapest salt that we can get. But other de-icers are magnesium chloride or calcium chloride. There are other kind of crystals, salt crystals, but they don't have the sodium in them. So any of those chloride salts, though, sodium chloride, magnesium chloride, calcium chloride, can lower the melting point and so get that ice to melt. Sodium chloride can get ice to melt as low as 15 degrees Fahrenheit. So if you put some salt out today on a little bit of ice, you can get that to melt and take care of that slick spot, right? Magnesium chloride and calcium chloride can actually melt ice down to even lower temperatures. So they can be beneficial. And sometimes we see road crews are going to mix sodium chloride with some calcium chloride or magnesium chloride. But those other de-icing salts are a little bit more expensive. So if you just go to get the cheapest salt at the hardware store, you're getting sodium chloride.
And can you help us understand what is going on when you put down sodium chloride or magnesium chloride or whatever it is? What's actually happening to the ice that causes it to break down and ultimately melt?
Mm-hmm. So just like the sodium chloride has a little bond between the sodium and the chloride, water, our H2O, has bonds in between the H's, the hydrogens, and the O, the oxygen. And as long as you have water, molecules, you have those H's and O's are bonded together in that one water molecule. And then when water is liquid, those little H2O's are moving around under and over and bouncing off of one another. But temperature is really just a measure of how much energy there is in kind of molecules. So if you take the temperature of water that's like, let's say you got your tea water and it's really hot. I don't know what you drink your tea at, maybe 150 degrees. It means that those water molecules in your cup of tea are moving around super, super, super fast and bouncing off one another and bouncing off the teacup. And then as the temperature goes down, those water molecules are moving more and more slowly. And as the temperature continues to go down, if you took your cup of tea and you let it sit outside today, and it's below 32 degrees Fahrenheit or 0 Celsius, those water molecules are slowing down so much that eventually they kind of stop, and they pretty much stop. Now, we don't get too technical here, but they kind of quit moving past one another, and they kind of lock into place, and they would form an ice crystal, where one water molecule's H's are connected to another one's O's, hydrogen to oxygen, and they kind of bond in that way. But when you put salt in there, imagine all of a sudden now you've got another little molecule that is kind of getting in the way. And so where those water molecules want to kind of come and like hold hands together, now you got somebody else kind of running interference and preventing those water molecules from forming that bond with their neighbors and forming that ice crystal. So salt kind of runs interference and prevents the ice from forming.
Interesting.
Or it can get in the way and cause it to melt if we, you know, the sun's hitting on it too, especially.
Right. You mentioned that most of the time what we're talking about is sodium chloride, the most common kind of salt. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned some others that are more expensive and in some ways, in terms when it comes to melting things, actually more effective, like magnesium chloride. So all of those are all salts? They're different kinds of salt?
Yes. They're all salt, and because they all have chloride in them, they are all going to be detrimental to our fresh water. In fact, like any de-icer, it has a cost to our environment. As Nan said, everything you put down in the land goes into the water. So even if we use something, a non-salt or a non-chloride de-icer, like some people talk about using like pickle juice or beet juice or something that seems like, well, it's a food product, right? Like, or something that's organic. That sounds good. But organic material, technically, if it's organic, it doesn't mean it's grown without pesticides. You can have like organic beet juice. It means it has carbon in it. And carbon is food for us. And it's also food for microbes. So if organic materials make their way into our water, they become food for little bacteria and microbes in there. And as they eat, as those microbes eat the carbon, eat that organic de-icer, they also need to breathe in more and more oxygen. So organic de-icers lead to decreased oxygen in our fresh water, which means less oxygen for fish and other aquatic organisms. So pretty much anything that you're going to put down, just kind of take care of ice, does have a cost. And even sand, which doesn't melt ice, but it can provide traction over on top of ice. And it's good to use sand if salt isn't going to work. So if it's below 15 degrees, salt wise really encourages us to use sand instead of salt, because salt's not going to melt ice at that temperature. But even that sand has some negative impacts that can lead to sedimentation in our waterways and clog up drains, storm drains. So really the best thing to do is to get out there with your shovel and get that snow up as soon as possible. And if there is some ice, get out there with an ice scraper and scrape that up. Mechanical removal of the snow and ice is always the best. Hmm.
So in other words, there isn't anything we can put down that is completely safe in terms of environmental impact.
Yeah, you're right, Greg. The only environmentally safe de-icer is the one you don't use.
or one sweat and toil with an ice scraper.
Yes. Think of it though, you know, as your gym workout this winter, right? As many of us are not going to the gym. Now you want to, you know, gradually build up just like you would in the gym. You don't want to throw your back out. But I definitely, this Saturday, was out there in a few shifts to clear out my corner lot with lots of sidewalk and a pretty big driveway. Hmm.
We're speaking with Allison Madison. She's with the group Wisconsin Saltwise. And in anticipation of Salt Awareness Week, which is coming up in a couple of weeks, we're talking about the problem of salt in terms of when we salt our roads, when we salt our driveways to remove ice, that we are causing detriment to the environment, and in particular to our water. And so this is a cost about which we need to be aware, and that's why we're having this conversation today. So Allison Madison, one of the things we were just talking about is when you have ice on your driveway, well, first of all, try to get that snow moved before it turns into ice, but sometimes we have ice storms and it just becomes ice right away. But again, the best thing in terms of being environmentally sensitive is to simply remove it the old-fashioned physical way. That is the best thing you can do in terms of the environment. What about when we're talking, of course, about icing on our roadways? So is it the position of Wisconsin salt-wise that also for our roads, we should not be using salt?
So Wisconsin salt-wise is definitely promoting public safety first and foremost. And then with that, we feel like we can promote both public safety and the smart use of salt. So Wisconsin Saltwise has been working with municipalities largely in southern Wisconsin, but a bit throughout the state to help educate them to use the right amount of salt. And by the right amount of salt, there are specific application rates. So scientifically kind of determine how much salt needs to go down kind of per lane mile based on temperature to get us to melt the ice or the, you know, kind of clear the roads. And we've worked, Wisconsin Saltwise has worked with the Wisconsin DOT, worked with a number of private snow removal companies, worked with Minnesota, who's actually a bit ahead of Wisconsin in this kind of fight against the overuse of salt to develop these application rates. So a number, actually over 1,000 winter maintenance professionals in Wisconsin have been trained through a half-day smart salting workshop on how to kind of calculate and apply the right amount of salt. So companies and counties and municipalities have actually been able to both keep our roads safe and clear and reduce salt. So just last week, Wisconsin Saltwise helped facilitate a DNR Sustainable Strategies webinar, and we brought in the mayor of the city of Superior, the public works director from Cudahy, and Wes Enderline from UW-Whitewater. And one of the most remarkable stories was that of Mary Jo Lang from Cudahy. She talked about how Cudahy has reduced their salt use by 69%. So pretty much 70% salt reductions, and 50% of that, she said, was just due to calibrating their equipment. Mm-hmm. So calibrating equipment, letting users know exactly how much salt are they putting down when they turn the salt dial to 1, 2, 3, 4. In the past, there just hasn't been much thought about really dialing in and knowing the amount of salt that is being, you know, put down behind a truck. So salt has been relatively cheap. And as Nan said, it seems to just kind of disappear. We don't worry about it. But increasing rates of salt to those municipalities and counties that are putting it down, as well as increasing environmental awareness around salt, has led to pretty basic steps, right? To think, calibrate your equipment. Any farmer today would know, you know, how much fertilizer, how much nitrogen you're going to put down on your field, right? You're not going to throw money away and put down more than you need to and over-fertilize and lead to, you know, nitrate leaching into groundwater. But we haven't treated salt kind of with that same sort of, you know, respect and awareness. So in answer to your question, Greg, yes, we want both of these things. We want to keep roads safe and we want to reduce salt use. And we definitely believe there's evidence from stories like Cudahy, from Jefferson County, who's also reduced salt use by almost 70% on their state highways by calibrating equipment. And Jefferson has also started to incorporate, or I shouldn't say started to, they've been incorporating liquid brine. And so liquid brine really helps in salt reduction. Counties, municipalities are able to put down kind of a thin layer of salt water. So it's the same sodium chloride that we talked about earlier, But they can put that down on the pavement before the snow comes and before that precipitation comes down. And that salt, like, remember we talked about the sodium chloride kind of runs interference, right, between the water molecules. So in this case, a thin layer of that salt water on the roads before the snow comes down kind of acts like interference between the pavement and those water molecules. So with that little thin layer of salt brine on the roads before the snow comes down, kind of works like oil on a pan. So your food doesn't stick to the pan. So you can grab that spatula right underneath your egg or your food and or your pancake, right, and flip it versus trying to get the pancake scraping and scraping and scraping without any oil, right? It just sticks to that pan and you've got a mess. So that brine can work like the oil and help the plow drivers to just grab that snow. It just comes up so much more easily and they don't need to use as much salt afterwards.
Wow. Fascinating.
If I could just interject quickly, most of us don't know that great strides have been made in terms of the technologies that municipalities can use in order to reduce their salt distribution or their salt applications. And I'd like to give a quick shout out to Connie Fortin of Fortin Consulting. They're from Michigan and they're kind of leaders in the industry in terms of educating municipalities and bringing these kinds of improved technologies to the forefront. So one of the things that Connie recommends, in addition to always calibrating your trucks, several times actually during salting season, is to invest in a thermometer that takes the road temperature. Because again, these chloride applications only work at certain temperatures. And it doesn't matter how much you put down, if it doesn't work below 15 degrees, it's just not going to work. And that's one thing homeowners and property owners need to realize too. You've got to read the directions on the bag, depending upon which one you're purchasing. Calcium chloride, magnesium chloride, sodium chloride, it has a temperature range in which it will work. And beyond that, it's just you're wasting money and also contaminating our watershed. There are road construction technologies now that include much darker pavement so that sunlight is absorbed and the pavement gets warmer than usual so that ice doesn't form. There are all kinds of things that are happening to assist with salt reduction. The other part of it is it's a learning curve. The idea is to make the road safe, make a sidewalk safe, make a parking lot safe. But perfection isn't the goal. So you can make something perfectly safe and there may still be some ice on it and you have to drive appropriately. You know, you may not be able to go 45 or 60 or 70. You can slow down a bit and still remain safe. And at the same time, you're using less de-icing chemicals. So we all have to kind of work together on this to do the right thing. It's all of our responsibilities. And there's a number of ways to do that. And I just want to mention one more thing. There are these things that you can put on the bottom of your shoes. One brand name is Yak Tracks. There are all kinds of things. They're called ice cleats. And they just are phenomenal. You won't fall down on the ice if you put these on your shoes or your boots. That's another way to remain safe, not fall down, and, you know, remain healthy and uninjured. And they're everywhere now. I mean, they're just in Walgreens, they're at grocery stores, they're everywhere. You can order them online. So that's a good investment, and they are relatively inexpensive. And you can go out there and enjoy winter without falling down.
So there are ways in which we can enjoy ice or live with it safely. It's good for us to be kind of thinking about this. Allison Madison, when your group is reaching out to various municipalities, you've already told us about some really gratifying success stories. I suspect that not everybody is equally open or receptive to some of these new understandings or new ways of doing things. But by and large, how would you characterize municipalities out there in terms of their receptiveness to some of this information?
Yeah, Greg. So, I mean, as humans, we are all kind of resistant to change, right? And I would say that, you know, winter maintenance professionals are no different than the rest of us, right? And we definitely don't want to just feel like we're being talked at. If you have, you know, expertise, if you've been, you know, doing your job for 20 years and you have someone come in who doesn't do your job and is going to tell you how to do it differently or better, you're going to be a little skeptical. So that said, Connie Fortin, who Nan mentioned of Fortin Consulting, leads these trainings kind of across the state and has really, really done her homework. And all of her classes are co-led with people who are working in the industry. So she works with individuals who've worked in the public sector as well as the private sector in winter maintenance. So she really does kind of tell it like it is and connect with the audiences that we have. And by and large, the evaluations that we get from these classes are really outstanding. I remember a quote from one of the first classes that I helped facilitate, and somebody said, you know, I've been doing this for 30 plus years, and I really, you know, didn't think I was going to learn anything in this class today, and I was blown away. And I think that everybody who does winter maintenance needs to take this class. So, and that's really more the rule than the exception in our evaluations, believe it or not. So people do feel like they're being respected, and I think and valued. You know, I think we don't always as a society kind of recognize all the hard work that is being done by these winter maintenance crews, right? That are out there late at night, early in the morning, working to get our roads and sidewalks kind of safe for us as we head out. You know, and we had this expectation that those roads should be just totally clear, right? And as Nan said, you know, maybe the expectation that we should still be able to go 65 miles an hour down the road, or, you know, drive where we want to go in the middle of that snowstorm. So part of what Saltwise is trying to do is to both kind of promote the really great work of those winter maintenance crews that are working hard to keep our roads safe and use, you know, the right amount of salt, and make sure that the public kind of recognizes that as well and makes choices that can help support those winter maintenance professionals. So, you know, if we can avoid driving in the middle of the storm, we can really help out the crews, because we're one less vehicle out there for them to work around. And as we all know from kind of, you know, shoveling our own walks, if somebody walks over your sidewalk, tramps a few footsteps, that snow is a lot harder to get up than if it hasn't been walked over yet. So the same is true, you know, out on our roads. If our tire tracks are going back and forth, it's going to be harder for the plows to get that packed snow up off the roads.
I wish we had longer to talk about this. We really have just a couple minutes to summarize the damage that gets done when salt goes into our waterways. I saw on your website a really scary statistic, something about how is it a tablespoon of salt or a
teaspoon
of salt?
Teaspoon.
So worse, a teaspoon of salt can seriously pollute 5 gallons of water. In other words, it doesn't take a lot of salt to do damage. Allison, can you summarize briefly, I'm afraid, the kind of damage that we're talking about when salt gets into water, into fresh water?
Yeah. Yep. So 1 teaspoon of salt brings 5 gallons of water above what the DNR has decided is like the threshold that would negatively impact our aquatic organisms. So they begin to experience stress, a number of them, when there is salt between like 200 and 300 milligrams per liter. And some of them can tolerate more, but they begin to experience maybe, you know, reduced reproduction rates, or it's just more difficult for them to be living in that kind of salty water. They're adapted to fresh water. So we see that in small macroinvertebrates as well as different fish species. So so the biggest thing is that we want to start reducing salt use and getting people to be more aware of this. And I would highly encourage people to check out our website, wisconsinsaltwise.com. We have an awareness week coming up in January, as Greg mentioned, January 11th to the 15th, where you can learn from different scientists, water softening professionals, winter maintenance professionals, groundwater professionals, all about salt, what's being done, and how you can be a part of this.
That reminds me that we're not just talking about the salting of ice, but that also your organization is concerned about the softening of water and the fact that salt is involved in that process. And it sounds like also with that, we can make some better choices.
Yes, water softening salt is definitely something that is totally disappears, right? Once you put it in your softener, and I had no idea myself until starting this job that our wastewater treatment plants cannot remove that salt. So all the salt we put in our softener, we are pretty much dumping into the stream or the lake that our wastewater treatment plant discharges into. So by getting your water softeners optimized, making sure they're running as efficiently as possible with respect to salt, we can do big favors for our freshwater resources.
Wow. Allison Madison is with Wisconsin SaltWise, and Salt Awareness Week is coming up in early January. Again, what are the exact dates?
January 11th through the 15th.
Great. And if people want more information, I know they can go to your website. Is it simple to just Google Wisconsin SaltWise?
Yep, you can Google Wisconsin SaltWise. It's wisaltwise.com is the website. And there's a lot of great resources on there, and you can get my contact information and shoot me an email if you want to really kind of join the SaltWise team here of champions.
Very good. Yes, I visited the website this morning, and I was very impressed with all that is there. And it tackles many, many different facets of this situation and issue. Allison Madison with Wisconsin SaltWise, we really appreciate you being part of the morning show today. Thank you for sharing so much information. I know I learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners did as well. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Greg, and thank you, Nan, for the invitation.
Thank you, Allison.
Good to have you here. Nan, before you go, I know you have a couple of announcements you want to share with our listeners.
Yes, two announcements. Pringle Nature Center will be hosting Winter Solstice Night Hike on December 19th. It's $5 per person. You must register. And you, when you register, you'll be assigned a time that you and your group can hike. The time slots that remain open are 6:30 and 7 p.m. People who register will be checking in at Pringle before you take off on your guided hike. Hopefully you'll see lots of really beautiful stars and all kinds of things when you're out there. Go to the Pringle Nature Center website and you can register right there. And then Hawthorne Hollow will be also hosting a very astronomical event on December 23rd. That's Wednesday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. It involves wine with your winter solstice celebration. What happens is that you bring your own wine or beverage of choice, and while you're relaxing in a zero gravity chair, you'll enjoy a guided tour through the night sky. You'll be introduced to stars and planets, constellations, and other really cool astronomical points of interest. It's socially distanced. All the chairs are disinfected. Masks are required, but you can still have a wonderful evening under a winter sky. And again, just go to the Hawthorne Hollow website and you will be taken to registration just by clicking on the event.
Very good. So two holiday events that have been planned very carefully with the concerns of COVID in mind to allow people to, in a sense, gather, but carefully distanced and as safe as one can possibly be. And I appreciate you sharing that information. And Nan Calvert, I want to thank you for this whole year worth of really interesting programs. And we look forward to more collaborations in 2021.
Oh, thank you so much. It's my pleasure. And I look forward to the coming year as well. Happy holidays to everybody. Stay safe. And we'll see you again in 2021.
Very good.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we are going to be previewing a couple of special holiday offerings. One of them is a really intriguing virtual performance, virtual production of A Christmas Carol being presented by the Fleeing Artists Theater Company, directed by Alex Metalski. And we're going to be finding about the actor who died earlier this year, who is being memorialized in this production. He often portrayed the role of Scrooge. We'll be talking with director Alex Metalski and with a couple of the actors who are involved in this production, which the public can see next week. Also tomorrow on the morning show, we'll hear from Jim Schatzman and Julia Tsuchi from the Choral Arts Society about their next virtual offering as they go into their archives of impressive and interesting recordings from some of their past concerts. And that will be also part of the morning show tomorrow. Next week, before we go on a holiday hiatus from morning show broadcasts, we will be bringing you some very interesting conversations. On Monday the 21st, I am hoping to share with you an interview I'm planning to record later this afternoon with Reverend Warren Williams, who contracted COVID-19 earlier this year and actually had underwent a really frightening ordeal, unlike some of the people we have talked to on the program who experienced COVID-19 directly. His was a very, very serious case which required a hospitalization, and thankfully he has emerged whole and apparently recovered, and but it was a really, really scary ordeal, and he's going to be telling us about that. So a very close look at COVID-19 on Monday's morning show. On Tuesday, we're going to be talking about the efforts at Carthage College to combat racism and to secure greater inclusivity. I'll be speaking with Roger Moriano, who is the Assistant Dean of Students at Carthage and who heads up Carthage's efforts when it comes to combating racism and fostering greater diversity. And next Wednesday, the 23rd, we're going to be remembering the amazing Ray Forgione, with two archival interviews, one of them dating all the way back to the late 1990s and conducted by Bill Guy, talking about the creation of Harbor Park before anything had